Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 93, section 5, which is old single column, page 1018. Okay, we made it through the introduction to Machaventa Melchizedek himself last week. The main thing that strikes one, if all you know is the little snippets of Melchizedek from the Bible, that surprisingly, Melchizedek was on the scene long before Abraham. That Abraham is finally comes around down the road here a ways. Remember how they were giving us that little preface, that tiny little paragraph at the end of section 4, where they're saying that Abraham had attended the Salem school 3 different times, and then finally he became a convert. So, even when it finally rolled around that Abraham was in that neck of the woods, it still was a long process. So, that turns everything on its head. Of, instead of it being all about Abraham, as it appears in the Bible, it's actually Melchizedek is the story. Melchizedek of Salem is the third epical revelation to mankind. And Abraham is just a project that Melchizedek develops to engage very directly the main evolutionary stream of evolutionary religion. And Machaventa is, working other projects as well. So, that's for the uninitiated to the fifth epical revelation. That, it's that fact that definitely stands out. We have finally rolled around. It's now time to see how this rolls with when Abraham comes on the scene. We not only had that little paragraph of foreshadowing that I just mentioned, but recall that also there was a little mention there just before that in the latter part of section 4 to that big battle that we'll finally kind of hear about in sequential context here, as we get into the reading a little ways, that big battle between Abraham and a number of the neighboring kings and their armies, that Abraham ends up victorious. And remember, we were talking about that was where Machaventa was trying to encourage as peaceful a relations amongst the tribes as possible, but Abraham was very set on conquering everyone. We'll get into that in context now. Let's see. I don't think we have to tee anything else up. Let's just jump in and we'll see how they introduce Abraham to us here. I guess maybe other than saying, I'm not going to go in any great detail of comparing what they tell you here to the Bible story, as a fun little exercise on your own, pull out Genesis and read those passages about Abraham in there, and it's very fun to compare with what's in the Revelation you know, you can see just how much the scribes during the exile in Babylon modified and augmented the story, right, to fit into their agenda of bolstering the sagging spirits of the Hebrew people. Anyway, let's see what they've got here. Oh, yeah, yeah.
How long after the Exodus from Egypt did Melchizedek appear?
No, he's way before. He's way before.
Oh, he's way before.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I got that.
Yeah, long, long before.
Okay.
All right.
Section 5, the selection of Abraham. Although it may be an error to speak of, quote, chosen people, it is not a mistake to refer to Abraham as a chosen individual. Melchizedek did lay upon Abraham the responsibility of keeping alive the truth of one God as distinguished from the prevailing belief in plural deities.
Okay, so a couple things there in just that little introduction. This mentioned that last little bit first. Remember, we were emphasizing that as they were talking about what Melchizedek was trying to do, trying to very definitively foster a monotheistic approach to deity. Remember also he was trying to get them to take that monotheistic God concept and lift it up in their minds as much as they could, so that eventually when Jesus comes around and, you know, Michael incarnated as Jesus, he can refer up to the universal Father, and speak of him being a son come down from that universal Father. That whole vertical encouragement on the part of Jesus wouldn't have been possible if everyone had a very horizontal, planar concept of gods and mortals and ghosts and what have you, all kind of in the plane. So he was trying to foster that vertical idea, as well as the one God, like they're saying here. Now let's get to Abraham. So it may be an error to speak of chosen people, quote unquote. It is not a mistake to refer to Abraham as a chosen individual. Couple things. One, just notice the use of both error and mistake there. Okay. In other words, when they said error before, it's a kind of error that results from evil, not just mere error. Right? It's in the context of mistake. Mistaken judgment, wrong judgment, wrongly taken judgment. It's evil. Evil. Okay, why is evil even in play? I mean, why are we saying mistake? It's kind of right there to be appreciated when they use the expression chosen individual. Right? I mean, when you think about quote-unquote chosen people, you're just getting a very biased, individuated sense of things. It's biasing you away from unity. It's going to be an influence that will tend to disrupt relationship to genuine unity if you just fixate on some, localized, specialized group context, whatever, and make that everything, as it were. It's just like any ism in general, where you take some idea, which is some very individuality concept, and you falsely unityize it. Make it, see it as a, or try to treat it as a complete lifestyle solution, make it a false unity. That's what that ism suffix, is implying. So you have this same thing here. You know, it's just, it's in the false circumscribing of your worldview that's is going to have a tendency to disrupt your relationship to genuine unity, which humans have no, natural consciousness of. It's there by grace from roughly age 6 when you're circuited in the Holy Spirit. And eventually when you mature and can relate to such abstract concepts, you can foster a greater relationship to genuine unity. But, prior to that, you're suspect or you're susceptible, to stumbling into the exaltation of individuality and disrupting your relationship, that tenuous, childlike relationship to unity. Okay, so, just think of a tiny little paragraph like that. But, all they have to do is just use the word mistake and kind of even call contrast or call attention to it by the contrast between mistake and error. And, if you're looking at the details, and it just awakens a whole picture in your mind, and going, okay, well, why did they do that? I'm about to read about Abraham. Why are they trying to give me such a philosophic encouragement up front? Well, why is Melchizedek going to develop and foster this relationship to Abraham? Why is Melchizedek incarnated in the first place? All right, there's this diminishing relationship to unity. So much so that the Melchizedek receivers are worried that there's going to be, a spiritual uplifter comes to uplift the existing relationship to unity. If there is no relationship to unity, there's nothing to uplift. There's an emergency situation. That's why back in 1980 BC, right, he incarnated himself, knowing that in the not too distant future, it turned out 1,973 years later, right, in 7 BC, Jesus was going to be born, right? And there was only that little bit of time to try to deal with a severely evaporating phenomenon on the planet. Now, we all know, I think we mentioned that before, the Melchizedeks had no idea that in the 6th century BC, there was going to be this coming out of Mother Deity, there was going to be this spiritual quickening where the whole was going to give the parts a booster shot, okay? They're just looking at the parts, have no idea, none of the celestials, had any idea. There was going to be this budding coalescence out of the whole that would really save the day so that there was something for Jesus to work with. But nonetheless, that's why they're here. See, between the lines, they're actually trying to get you to think again about, why we're reading about this. Right? Because there was a genuine spiritual emergency back then. Remember we point that out frequently. Back 4,000 years ago, the emergency was a spiritual emergency. Okay, but now it's not a spiritual emergency. Right? The fifth epical revelation is again an emergency revelation. Okay, but it's not a spiritual emergency. It's a philosophic emergency. It's a civilizational emergency. But back then, right, it was a genuine spiritual emergency. Right? This relationship to unity was diminishing fast. And, so it was much more of an individual issue. When we're talking about the philosophic, the civilizational emergency now, right, it's not because any of us as individuals are in jeopardy. Right? The bestowal of the spirit of truth and the universal bestowal of thought adjusters because of it, right, dealt with that issue. That's not an issue anymore. All of us as individuals are fine. You can take your salvation for granted. You'll get to the first mansion world. You can still choose to go to iniquity there if that's what your heart is set on. But for the world right now in front of us, right, there isn't a spiritual emergency, but there's definitely a philosophic emergency. Okay. Yep.
What do you mean by unity? You mean the belief in one God?
No. That's a tricky thing right there. Like what I just said about how naturally humans have no idea what the word unity, as it's used in the Urantia book, what that's referring to.
It's a church.
Yeah, exactly. Isn't that a name of a church? Yeah. No, it's not that. There's a difference between unity and oneness in the Urantia book. Now, etymologically, unity and oneness are identical words, okay? But in the Urantia book, they're very different. Unity is referring to, see, again, you have to kind of think philosophically and abstractly to even approach it. You can think about it as continuumness. Think about how there's all this individuality. There's the individual persons in the room. There's individual objects in the room. But if you reflect on that, you go, yeah, but all these individual objects aren't island universes. For instance, you can hear me talking right now. You can see other objects. There's an associativity that's present. Somehow, this individuality is in an association, a complex association. Where does that associativity come from? There's two basic conceptual elements. You have individuality on the one hand and unity on the other hand, and they're in juxtaposition, and there's a superadditive consequence of the relationship between the two, which is associativity. The unity is that fact that you recognize must exist because you can observe the associativity and you know it doesn't come into existence magically. And so you recognize it's there, but you can't kick it, you can't see it. Well, it's because it's tied to the other substance, spirit substance, that the substance you can't kick or see right now. You've got two substances, matter and spirit. And hence two qualities, individuality and unity. And they relate to one another and produce associativity. But humans have a vague notion of this, even if they're not highly educated. We're all encircled in the Holy Spirit. We have vague senses about some of these things. And so humans talk about unity. But since all they really are thinking about is matter, they decide that what unity means is uniformity. People here have heard me say, uniformity is poor man's unity, quote unquote. I mean, think about how when someone has a bias to their unity consciousness, to their spiritual consciousness, they have a strong tendency to want to establish uniformities of form or behavior or whatnot. Every faith is a good example. Think about how every Christian church, has common forms and whatnot. You have uniformity of rituals. It's not just Muslims that have uniformity of rituals. Buddhists have uniformity of rituals. Baha'is have uniformity of rituals, whatever. I mean, that uniformity, or let's all, let's try to get everyone on the planet to pray at the same time. Or let's get all your Urantia book readers to read a certain passage at the same time. Any of those sorts of thoughts of uniformity like that. See, uniformity of individuality, people think they're being spiritual when they do that. They think they have a relationship to unity when they do that. See, and it's not. It's just uniformity. It's an illusion. So it's it's very important. And you don't do unity in the outer life. You do unity in the inner life. You know, which mankind knows basically nothing of. That domain that's above your feelings about the outer life. The genuine kingdom of heaven, the genuine inner life, the genuine inner sanctum. You know, that's where, you know, it's when you are reflecting that you're there in that upper domain and can begin to recognize the logical existence of unity. Right? But if you're just going with your feelings about the objects in front of you, you know, and how uniform they are or aren't or something like that, right? You're not, you know, you have no way to know the literalness of what the word unity is referring to. And then, just a little aside, oneness is indivisibility. You know, the simplest way to think about oneness is we have this triune actuality, individuality, associativity, unity, matter, mind, spirit. We have this, when you bring that together as a triunity and think about encompassing that, wrapping a sphere around that, say, right, that can't be broken, right, that holds it together as one, that's oneness. Your personality is what can wrap around and make your cosmic triune nature indivisible. You know, you can stand unmoved, right? When things are assaulting you that would normally break someone, you know, they don't have indivisibility. You can, if you have, you know, begun to exercise your genuine personality and encompassed yourself, you know, in its oneness. So, unity is divisible. Oneness is indivisible. Yep, anything else?
What you said is wonderful, but here in this paragraph, Melchizedek was, for Abraham, it was to keep alive the truth of one God,
mm-hmm,
as distinguished from the prevailing belief in plural deities.
Right, right.
So that's what, you know.
Yeah, like I said up front, I mean, it's one thing what he's doing with Abraham and, you know, and like individuals, fostering monotheism. But you know, what I'm getting at is what's behind the scenes of what's happening up front. Now, philosophically, what is the issue that the Melchizedek receivers are addressing? Right? You know, it's because minds are have less and less relationship to unity inside. People are just descending into an in-the-moment, animal-like individuality. You know, they're losing their character. They're losing their integrity. See, their indivisibility. Yeah, things are falling apart. All right. Let's keep going here.
The choice of Palestine as the site for Machaventa's activities was in part predicated upon the desire to establish contact with some human family embodying the potentials of leadership. At the time of the incarnation of Melchizedek, there were many families on earth just as well prepared to receive the doctrine of Salem as was that of Abraham. There were equally endowed families among the red men, the yellow men, and the descendants of the Andites to the west and north. But again, none of these localities were so favorably situated for Michael's subsequent appearance on earth as was the eastern shore of the Mediterranean Sea. The Melchizedek mission in Palestine and the subsequent appearance of Michael among the Hebrew people were in no small measure determined by geography, by the fact that Palestine was centrally located with reference to the then existent trade, travel, and civilization of the world.
Okay, in other words, the Melchizedek receivers assessing the world and figuring out where they're going to do this mission and with whom, they assessed the situation exactly the way Gabriel did, right? The two of them don't have to be reading each other's notes or anything. I mean, it's just an objective assessment. They're going to come to the same conclusion. And of course, then coincidentally, quote unquote, right, everything works together, as we already were talking about last week, that, you know, so much of what Jesus did was, the stage was set for him by what Melchizedek did. He had to kind of follow suit. And you know, like they're pointing out here, I mean, sometimes he's following suit because it's just, there's really no other option. It's just the way it needs to happen. But in some issues, you know, the mores system that Jesus found himself with, you know, that Melchizedek had a lot to do with setting the stage for, you know, Jesus just had to roll with that. So, you know, this, it just reminds you of how all the different revelators, all the different celestial beings and their activity engaging mortals, you know, it's not some simplistic uniformity, right? And there's a sequentiality to it. What a particular individual or individuals do, the next individuals have to strike step with that, you know. And think about how humble all that is, and how respectful of the evolutionary process all that is, as opposed to so many people that favor their unity consciousness today, where their first thought is, well, you know, nothing in existence is right. You know, we need a revolution, you know, and we need to overthrow everything, you know, and start afresh in my image. Right? You know, it's so lacking in humility and respect for the evolutionary process. You know, and again, that's, remember what I'm just talking about there. That's why there's a fifth epoch of revelation. It's that emergency, you know, that sort of you're not the boss of me emergency, you know, that's going on today. That's why this is here.
Don't tell that to my wife. And the other thing, interesting thing here is the geography thing. Uh-huh. It just keeps popping up
a lot.
A lot of instances.
It's just, let's emphasize that again. You know, you know how much that's mentioned up in the, you know, with Jesus. Again, it's just, you have this nexus point where not only are you kind of at the center of a lot of the known world activity, but you're at a crossroads of a lot of the trade and travel and whatnot, you know, in a greater geographic sense. So it's a very prime place.
But throughout history, you know, whether it's ice ages or whatever, the, you know, the climate, the geography,
yep,
has a lot to do with, yep, influencing,
yeah,
you know, the pattern of evolution.
Yeah, great points. And you can take it to that bigger picture. We've noticed how many times climate and geography and whatnot affected biologic evolution, religious evolution, social evolution, etc.
New one's
going to
do.
Yeah.
And he needed to be near a family or associated with a family.
Right, the strong family elements and, right, yep.
It seems like those are two super key, the trade, mm-hmm, and family.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and you notice they mentioned the yellow men there, you know, just like they do when they're talking about Gabriel, you know, selecting strong family.
What did you just say?
Yeah, they mentioned there were equally endowed families among the red men, the yellow men, and the descendants. You know, they mentioned the yellow men, you know, here too. Mm-hmm. Okay, so anyway, so you've got this same conclusion that Palestine is the place for this to happen, you know, and so, as we mentioned when we first started on Melchizedek here, hence Jerusalem gets started up as a sacred place long ago.
I'm curious, it mentioned these other races. The red man had very little of the Anakutta. So was that not really a factor?
They're just pointing out that the primary Sangic offers, you know, possibilities. You know, we know that, you know, you know, even when white man first arrived in North America, you know, he discovered that there were definitely Amerinds that were much closer to you know, to a more developed civilization than others. You know, some of them were functioning in a very primitive, savage mode, but others were, you know, right on the edge of developing, you know, a rather significant civilization. Remember how they talk about that earlier in the book when they talk about, you know, civilization, that Red Man just needed a little bit of help with his tendency to tear himself apart, you know, with his zeal, you know, with intertribal warfare. You know, he needed a fostering, sort of a coordinating influence, right, to help him out. But genetically, right, he's a they're the leading edge primary Sangiks, and you know, there's a, you know, so the degree to which they hadn't killed off their best genetics, you know, in all of their intertribal wars, right, there was, you know, some decent, you know, genetics there. All right, let's keep going here.
For some time, the Melchizedek receivers had been observing the ancestors of Abraham, and they confidently expected offspring in a certain generation who would be characterized by intelligence, initiative, sagacity, and sincerity. The children of Terah, the father of Abraham, in every way met these expectations. It was this possibility of contact with these versatile children of Terah that had considerable to do with the appearance of Machaventa at Salem, rather than in Egypt, China, India, or among the northern tribes.
Okay, so another little element. You know, off and on, we refer to this. You'll see another one later on here. This is a reminder of just how calculable mankind is. Right, there's very limited, unpredictable personality in play in all of humankind. So, you know, when you know the laws of material energy, mindal energy, spiritual energy, how they work together, all right, you can calculate what's going to happen, you know, on this planet to the 12th decimal place, okay, you know, way in advance. You know, remember that for us, each of us as an individual, at our moment of conception, right, they look at the genetics you've got and where you're going to be born. You know, they send that information to Divinington. They set up a simulation of your mind that your thought adjuster practices in, where he basically, you know, your whole life plays out. He follows you through the whole thing, because almost everything, I mean, what I'm saying right now could have been calculated, you know, a million years ago. I mean, we're very calculable yet, you know, very little, free will really happening. I mean, that's kind of part of the emergency, right? That we're, you know, what little unnaturalness we have, we're losing and going into a hopeless primitive naturalness again. So we have a philosophic emergency. We need to be less calculable. And then we need to take that unnatural, less calculable nature and apply it wisely. Okay. But, I mean, you know, for some time, okay, they know in a particular lineage, right, that they're, you know, and they know the qualities, intelligence, initiative, sagacity, sincerity. You know, he's going to have 2.5 units of sincerity, you know, 1.86 units of initiative. Right? I mean, you know, it's just calculable. Okay. You know, and so all of us should, you know, take on this fact, you know, very earnestly, and find some serious humility to temper our self-righteousness, right? You know, and, you know, recognize that so much of what we do isn't as fancy as we think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you
connect with God and little God in your life? Are you just as calculable?
If you're connecting with the real God, that means you're really personal and you're really not as calculable. But like we've been, you know, the problem is, for most people, God is just the ghost cult notion, God. He's not the real God, you know, and that's all calculable stuff. And so again, you know, it's like I encourage all the time. Now, it's not bad. It's not bad that you start out as a child. You know, we're just trying to emphasize that you start out as a child, right? You know, and to not assume otherwise, right? Humbly recognize you start out as a child. And just take on the challenge to work towards maturity. Yeah.
To me, that whole concept is really reassuring. At first, you know, when I thought about, oh gosh, they pretty much planned me out ahead of time. I really don't have all this free will. I do, but I really don't have all this choice. But then I said to myself, well, you know, I'm pretty bad at planning my life anyway. If I can trust the fact that that part of God within me actually has a plan, it's got to be a whole lot better than my plan. And it's probably going to make me a whole lot happier, and it's probably the right thing for me.
Yeah.
Because they know a whole lot more than I do, is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm being able to tell from where I started, so to speak, and how to get there. I imagine when you finally get there, you know, to the core of finality, you know, you've gotten beyond that. And
oh, yeah.
A lot of experience and right. So on and so forth. But to me, it's kind of, although it seems a little bit frightening, and frightening is maybe not the right word, of somebody else's control of me, so to speak.
But again, it's not someone else. It's it's no more scary than the fact that when you drop a ball, it falls at exactly the same rate of acceleration. it's just law, right?
But it's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, the law was designed by God. The law is good, okay? But the beautiful thing to discover is God gave you free will on top of that law, which He also gave you, and wants you to take a hold of that and discover the wisdom to exercise that free will well on top of that law foundation until you can eventually achieve genuine liberty in law. Okay? That's the whole point. The law's the context for your liberty. You know, your goal is liberty in law. So if you're not given law to begin with, that's not even, that goal's not possible. Okay?
I was going to say that it might not seem like you have that much free will, but, and it's reassuring to be directed, but in each given situation, you have a lot of free will in how you address the situation and how the situation materializes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's where you have free will.
Right. You have free will on the inside. You know, no one can dictate how you respond to something. They can lock you in chains so you can't move your arms or whatever. But you can respond positively to that negative stimulus inside. You don't have to be a helpless victim of how the world besets you. That's your free will. All right. So anyway, so we've got this family, and if you know the Bible, you know they work you down to Terah, and then the big story begins. Then Abraham enters on the stage. The way it really happened, the Melchizedeks are watching this, and they're going to see to it that Terah's family comes into relationship with Machaventa, etc. It's all a vast manipulation that the Melchizedeks are up to tweak this to happen. Okay, let's see how that works here a little bit.
Terah and his whole family were half-hearted converts to the Salem religion, which had been preached in Chaldea. They learned of Melchizedek through the preaching of Ovid, a Phoenician teacher who proclaimed the Salem doctrines in Ur. They left Ur, intending to go directly through to Salem, but Nahor, Abraham's brother, not having seen Melchizedek, was lukewarm and persuaded them to tarry at Haran. And it was a long time after they arrived in Palestine before they were willing to destroy all of the household gods they had brought with them. They were slow to give up the many gods of Mesopotamia for the one god of Salem.
Okay, so remember, we're in the Fertile Crescent here. So, you know, you've got this standard flow of people back and forth, you know, up from Palestine, you know, reaching the peak, you know, in what's now southern Turkey, and coming back down, you know, between the rivers in Mesopotamia, you know. So there's this constant exchange going back and forth, you know, in the Fertile Crescent there. And so, you know, word has gotten out about Melchizedek, you know, all the way over down to the, you know, southern part of Mesopotamia, down there to Ur. And, you know, so Terry and his family know all about, you know, Melchizedek long before they even set out. You know, it's not like in the Bible where, you know, Abraham and crew just, you know, end up over there. And, oh, then there's this little incident where they mention there's this guy named Melchizedek, and no one knows what to think of that. And, you know, it's just a very different story, see. You know, to have, you know, already the beginnings of Melchizedek missionaries, see, you know, in play, even this early on. This Ovid guy from Phoenicia, you know, to the north of Palestine, you know, has already headed over there and has been preaching and preaching. You know, I think you guys all know that, you know, in Mesopotamia, things, you know, there were all kinds of different gods, and you have that whole concept of household gods, and so they have all these little idols, you know, and it took them a long time to finally let go of all of that. And see, and that's a great reminder, you know, that these lowercase g gods, you know, are literally idols. You know, so again, it just, it's so horizontal. Like I said, I mean, Melchizedek has got to try to not only get it to one God, but then get something that's, you know, exalted, instead of, you know, such a lowly, anthropomorphic, silly concept, you know, and down in the plain. All right.
A few weeks after the death of Abraham's father, Terah, Melchizedek sent one of his students, Jerem the Hittite, to extend this invitation to both Abraham and Nahor. Quote, "Come to Salem, where you shall hear our teachings of the truth of the eternal Creator, and in the enlightened offspring of you two brothers shall all the world be blessed." End quote. Now Nahor had not wholly accepted the Melchizedek gospel. He remained behind and built up a strong city-state which bore his name. But Lot, Abraham's nephew, decided to go with his uncle to Salem.
Okay, so I forgot to mention, so, you know, they're coming, I should probably do it this way so it's correct. They're coming up from Ur, you know, and they're getting up there at the top, you know, what's now, you know, in southern Turkey, and they stall out there, you know, instead of continuing on down to Palestine. And so, you know, Melchizedek's like, well, I think I need to send someone, encourage him to come the, you know, the rest of the way. They got halfway here and stalled out. See, so again, it's all this tweaking, all this, you know, encouraging, fostering, manipulating of the situation. You know, there's nothing coincidental about Abraham, you know, being the father of the Jewish people, as it were, right? I mean, it's a completely manipulated situation by the Melchizedek receivers, you know, into being what it is, you know, what we, you know, have in the Bible, of, you know, for founding the Jewish religion.
Are the people that started out in Palestine under the Melchizedek teaching, are they the foundation for the Jewish people?
Well, no, I mean, it's, you know, remember, you've got all of these Semitic peoples in the Near East there. You know, it's a polyglot phenomenon. And, you know, as I was just saying, you know, Abraham really starts to launch this idea of the Hebrew people, you know, and kind of assembling a people with a common culture. You know, everyone kind of has the same genetics, basically. Yeah, you know, but assembling a people with a common culture, you know, towards a common end. But it really got solidified with Moses, of course.
So
you know, long after.
Moses ushered out were their descendants.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Descendants. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Abraham's descendants,
yeah.
Yeah.
It was Jacob who was
Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, you know, all of that, you know, that whole story.
My question is about Salem. Where was Salem? Was it in
Salem is what you know eventually became Jerusalem.
Oh, Salem eventually. Oh. And so he came from which was near the Persian Gulf in Mesopotamia.
Yeah, yeah, clear down in you know, the southern Mesopotamia. Like I said, you know, you're going, you know, up and down on the Fertile Crescent. You know.
So Phoenicia is Lebanon.
Yeah, it's Lebanon. Yeah, yeah. you know, and the Hittites are you know up there, you know, in what's now Turkey, and you know, yeah, so yeah, it's kind of appropriate for him to send that person up to that neck of the woods, see, to talk to Abraham. Okay, so yeah, again, like I said, you could go on and on and on about all the detailed comparisons between what they're saying here and what's in the Bible. Yeah, there's so much that's not historical in the story in the Bible, you know, because they weren't trying to be historians, the people that took the historical records and wrote those stories. They weren't writing a history. There already were histories, right? They were writing a story to try to give the Jewish people a sense of integrity in the face of being in exile in Babylon. So, you know, it just, you know, they don't have factual historical accuracy in mind. They're not trying to deceive or anyone. It's just not their agenda, you know. And so, you know, to get the actual historical facts pinned down, you know, clears up a lot of the confusion in the biblical story. And I'll let you go back and forth between the two if you're interested to compare the two. All right, keep going here.
Upon arriving at Salem, Abraham and Lot chose a hilly fastness near the city where they could defend themselves against the many surprise attacks of northern raiders. At this time, the Hittites, Assyrians, Philistines, and other groups were constantly raiding the tribes of central and southern Palestine. From their stronghold in the hills, Abraham and Lot made frequent pilgrimages to Salem.
Jeez, again, just that whole different thing. You know, so they arrived there in Palestine, you know, and set up camp, you know, in a secure location near to where Machaventa was. And it's just, you know, Machaventa is in the driver's seat of you know, everything that's going on, and not Abraham. You know, you could say that instead of it, as it appears in the Bible, where Abraham is the leader, no, Melchizedek's the leader, and Abraham's a follower. He's his prime kind of main evolutionary stream follower, prime disciple for the evolutionary stream.
I was just thinking, I guess these attacks are getting under Abraham's skin here over time.
Well, yeah, we'll get to that in a minute about how that, you know, how that all happens here. In a couple paragraphs, I'll talk about that. But I just reminded myself, I forgot to mention about, you know, how the story is different. Remember, you know, you may remember that in the Bible, you know, when they when he sent that that emissary up to, you know, to talk to him, that Jerem guy, you know, and this quote, "Come to Salem, where you shall hear our teachings of the truth of the eternal Creator, and in the enlightened offspring of you two brothers shall all the world be blessed." You know, of course, basically that passage in the Bible is Yahweh talking to Abraham.
Yeah.
you know. Because remember how the whole story, when it got reworked, all the interactions between Melchizedek and Abraham that were in the historical records that they were working with, they just reworked all that, you know, and made it, you know, more grandiose and mystical and whatnot, and had Yahweh talking to Abraham, you know, the Lord, quote unquote, talking to, you know, to Abraham. Yeah. You know, in the Bible, when you see L-O-R-D, you know, a lot of translations, and it's all caps, L-O-R-D, you know, that means it's Yahweh in the Hebrew text. But no, it's not the Lord. It's not Yahweh. It's not the volcano God talking to Abraham. You know, it's Melchizedek talking, you know, and here even indirectly, he's sent a messenger to give, you know, this message. Okay.
Oh, are there any of those historical records left?
No. See, none of those. You know, but there were two of them, and they're actually referred to. Those big collections of historical records are referred to in the Old Testament. They weren't trying to hide or anything. I mean, everyone knew about these things. Like I said, there was nothing. No one was trying to deceive. It's just they were trying to tell a story that would inspire people, you know. And the fact that those stories became a sacred text, and you know, you can still go to the bookstore and buy it today, whereas the other things that didn't become a sacred text, you know, were lost, you know, long ago, we don't have copies of them anymore, but. But, you know, scholars that study it, you know, not only do you have those references to those two collections of histories, but, you know, they can tell how the authors of various books of the Bible are drawing from certain sources and whatnot. You can just tell by the way it's constructed and stuff. So, but, you know, the Revelators basically are... You give the scholars the little tidbits that make it crystal clear. You know, basically they'll say, you know, that thing you've wondered about, scholars, yeah, that's correct. Or that thought you had, no, that's incorrect. Or, you know, they clear up some of those details for the scholars to help properly sort out the history of how the Bible came to be, you know, what we have today. Okay.
Not long after they had established themselves near Salem, Abraham and Lot journeyed to the valley of the Nile to obtain food supplies, as there was then a drought in Palestine. During his brief sojourn in Egypt, Abraham found a distant relative on the Egyptian throne, and he served as a commander of two very successful military expeditions for this king. During the latter part of his sojourn on the Nile, he and his wife Sarah lived at court, and when leaving Egypt, he was given a share of the spoils of his military campaigns.
Yeah, so, very different than what you have in the Bible, you know. the Pharaoh was actually a relative, so, you know, and none of this foolishness of stealing, you know, Abraham's wife or, you know, any of that sort of stuff like the Bible story. But, you know, they did... go down to Egypt because there was a drought going on, and you know, they needed food for Palestine. So, you know, that intro to the story in the Bible, that's correct. But, you know, the whole details after that, right? You know, the authors of Genesis totally reworked that.
It must have been quite a personality just to take over as a head of the military,
and just
like that, just
haven't
showed up in town.
Yeah, so, you know, this is...
So it shows you why they picked him.
Right, yeah, this isn't just Bob from Ur, see? Yeah, okay, this, you know, I mean, he has a relative that's the Pharaoh of Egypt, okay? I mean, this is some solid genetics, right? And, you know, it's a very established greater family, et cetera, yeah. You know, the Melchizedeks, you know their stuff in selecting him. you know, and the fact that he's, you know, doing these military campaigns and having all these spoils that he gets to keep and stuff. I mean, it's just so different than the story in the Bible. It's pretty fun to, you know, compare the two. All right, keep going.
It required great determination for Abraham to forego the honors of the Egyptian court and return to the more spiritual work sponsored by Machaventa. But Melchizedek was revered even in Egypt. And when the full story was laid before Pharaoh, he strongly urged Abraham to return to the execution of his vows to the cause of Salem.
Very different than, you fooled me about your wife, you know, get out of here. It's a very different story than what's in Genesis. You know, and just look at the respect that's already well in place before the Abraham story gets started. Melchizedek, you know, is practically as revered as a godlike individual, you know, from Egypt throughout the entire Fertile Crescent all the way over to the Persian Gulf, right? It makes the story so much different, and you know, to know that there's this Melchizedek context that was established that all this is actually playing out in, you know, and how look at how humbly respectful the Pharaoh is of Machaventa and Melchizedek, you know, just. You're talking about Pharaoh here, okay? A guy that, you know, has some pretty exalted thoughts about himself, okay? All right, so Melchizedek is a very commanding enemy. You know, we've wondered about his, you know, his presence and stuff, his genetics and, you know, what I mean, okay, he obviously was a very commanding individual, could easily get the respect of the Pharaoh. Yeah, he had the three concentric circles on his breastplate. Did you have something you wanted to ask?
Machaventa, I was just looking at the index as to who he was. What Machaventa is it?
Machaventa is. Machaventa. Yeah, it's just, as I said when we first started this, for the Melchizedeks that they refer to in the book that were part of the 12 that were the receivers. They give them a kind of a quote-unquote first name, and I haven't figured out the coinage of Machaventa yet, but it's just a way of distinguishing amongst them to give them an additional name like that. I mean, it obviously isn't, you know, this isn't some name they actually have. I mean, no one is, you know, is on high is speaking English words derived from Latin and Greek and Northern European roots or anything, right? I mean, you know, these are all words that are just coined for the benefit of the revelation.
Say Mac.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's keep going.
Abraham had kingly ambitions, and on the way back from Egypt, he laid before Lot his plan to subdue all Canaan and bring its people under the rule of Salem. Lot was more bent on business, so after a later disagreement, he went to Sodom to engage in trade and animal husbandry. Lot liked neither a military nor a herder's life.
And so, you know, didn't want to be the nomadic herder or the cannon fodder or whatnot. So in other words, just like the Bible story has, I mean, he actually was in Sodom. Lot was living in Sodom. Okay, so that part is historically a fact. You know, all the other stuff is falderal, basically. But you know, and there was this parting of the ways. You know, it's just basically in the Bible story. You know, if you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. You know, they decided to go their separate ways. But here you see, you know, like I said, the kingly ambition thing is coming here. See, so it's really he got the gears turning down there in Egypt, you know, on those military campaigns that he was leading for the Pharaoh. You know, that's what got his juices flowing on. Ooh, this is fun. I'm going to conquer all of Palestine. You know, and of course Melchizedek is like, this is problematic enough to begin with. Now I got to deal with this. See, and it's all just, see, that wouldn't have happened if there hadn't been a drought. So they wouldn't have gone down to Egypt. I'm sure Machaventa could have worked much more, you know, from a foundation up with Abraham. And instead, he's got this whole issue that he's going to have to work through with Abraham, kind of get this out of his system. No? Okay. Again, like you were saying, John, just how much geography, climate, you know, whatnot, you know, affects history. All right.
Upon returning with his family to Salem, Abraham began to mature his military projects. He was soon recognized as the civil ruler of the Salem territory and had confederated under his leadership seven nearby tribes. Indeed, it was with great difficulty that Melchizedek restrained Abraham, who was fired with a zeal to go forth and round up the neighboring tribes with the sword, that they might thus more quickly be brought to a knowledge of the Salem truth.
Well, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, and that just, you know, went on all the way through Zoroaster and Muhammad. let's get them all to your religion via the sword. So there's just a long-standing tradition in the Near East to take that approach. Fired with a zeal, sixth adjutant. Right? So, you know, instead of Machaventa working with Abraham to get his energy of zeal, his sixth adjutant, directed up to these exalted ideals, like you're talking about, trying to lift up and get that ideal that you can direct your zeal up towards. No, immediately he has his zeal directed horizontally at things, you know, and ideas about those things instead of at ideals. All right, so this is a huge problem that Machaventa is going to have to work through with him, get this out of his system. However, right, we know that the Most High Observer, not looking at the situation the way Machaventa Melchizedek is looking at it, you know, Machaventa is here for this spiritual emergency. The Most High Observer rules in the kingdoms of men, right? And he's got plans for Abraham that don't jive with Machaventa's plans for Abraham. And yeah. So the Most High Observer is going to make use of Abraham for a little while, and then Machaventa can have him. The wild territory needs to be tamed a little bit, and that means there's got to be a tamer. And Abraham is just the perfect one to do it. It all works out. Like I was saying before, we all have to humbly start with what is handed to us by those that went before us or those that are around us right now. I mean, you can't be all self-righteous about it and say, well, I'm not going to accept anything that came before me or what's around me right now. I want to rework everything in my image. You need to just go with the flow of the evolutionary process more. All right.
Melchizedek maintained peaceful relations with all the surrounding tribes. He was not militaristic and was never attacked by any of the armies as they moved back and forth. He was entirely willing that Abraham should formulate a defensive policy for Salem, such as was subsequently put into effect, but he would not approve of his pupil's ambitious schemes for conquest. So there occurred a friendly severance of relationship, Abraham going over to Hebron to establish his military capital.
Remember, Hebron is, you know, south of Jerusalem a ways. You know, Jerusalem is kind of sort of straight west of the northern end of the Dead Sea, and Hebron is straight west of the middle of the Dead Sea. He heads south, and you know, the very fact that they couldn't see eye to eye, like I was just saying, it's appropriate. I mean, the Most High Observer has plans, so it'll be easier if they're, you know, if he's not cohabitating with Melchizedek anyway. So that's the way it plays out, and just, you know, the general context that they're describing here, you know, it's so different than in the Bible, where you've got all of these kings and their armies and whatnot, and, you know, and Abraham steps in and kind of magically, you know, takes control of all this sort of stuff. And it's like, no, I mean, Abraham, you know, has got a confederation of seven tribes, you know, that he's set up and all this. It's a very different story than, you know, the magic man, you know, story in the Bible. And we'll see that very definitively here in this next paragraph.
Abraham, because of his close connection with the illustrious Melchizedek, possessed great advantage over the surrounding petty kings. They all revered Melchizedek and unduly feared Abraham. Abraham knew of this fear and only awaited an opportune occasion to attack his neighbors. And this excuse came when some of these rulers presumed to raid the property of his nephew Lot, who dwelt in Sodom. Upon hearing of this, Abraham, at the head of his seven confederated tribes, moved on the enemy. His own bodyguard of 318 officered the army, numbering more than 4,000, which struck at this time.
Okay, so the thing about Lot getting, you know, caught up in, you know, and this warring, okay, that's in the Bible, okay, that actually, you know, was kind of basically did happen. Okay, but the biggie is, you know, in the Bible, it sounds like Abraham and 318 guys decimated everyone. You know, vast armies, you know, totally conquered by 319 guys. No. Right, the 318 are just the officers, and they rewrote the story. They dropped the more than 4,000 army part out of the story because they wanted. Remember, the whole point of the way they rewrote that story for the Old Testament is what we just saw at the beginning of what we read tonight: chosen people, quote unquote. Right. The whole point is to set up the concept that the Jews are the chosen people, and that all of history is kind of orbiting about them, and, you know, and it's filled with all this magical ability of the great leaders and what have you. Okay. All right, so that's a glaring fact. But, you know, see, they, you know, you can tell that there was a historical record. I mean, it had the precise number of 318 in it. That, you know, they transferred that over into Genesis. Right. They just dropped the inconvenient details for the whole fancy stuff, you know. You know, not to mention, like I said, you know, having Abraham talking with God all the time instead of with Melchizedek. Let's see, anything else there? You remember how... you know, we were talking, I mentioned this, how towards the end last time they referred to this battle with Chedorlaomer. Remember that fancy name of that one king? This is the battle, you know, here that, you know, we're in. And there's four armies. And so you'll see here in the next, part that they'll mention that fact, you know, that, yeah, I mean, in between the lines, they're telling you that, yeah, like the Bible story says, there was four armies. Okay.
When Melchizedek heard of Abraham's declaration of war, he went forth to dissuade him, but only caught up with his former disciple as he returned victorious from the battle. Abraham insisted that the God of Salem had given him victory over his enemies and persisted in giving a tenth of his spoils to the Salem treasury. The other 90% he removed to his capital at Hebron.
Now that paragraph, see, that's, you know, it's what was in the historical record, basically relative to that paragraph, that they kept the little details where they, you have that actual mention of Melchizedek in Genesis. See, that's what, you know, the setting. He's coming, well, I mean, Melchizedek's going out to try to sort of catch him beforehand, but he's, you know, he's way behind the curve, and meets Abraham when he's coming back, and then you get the tithing and, you know, and all that honoring of Melchizedek and the mystery of that that's in the Genesis passage. You know, so that's where that little vignette in Genesis occurs right there. See anything else there? Abraham is obviously going to, I mean, he not only came back from Egypt with a lot, you know, but the other 90% he removed to his capital. Okay, so he's going to become quite the deal here, see? He's going to have lots of wealth.
Well, I'm curious why the other Melchizedek receivers didn't, I mean, if this was an important thing to stop him, why didn't they go to Machaventa and say, hey, you know, this is in the works. I mean, there's no...
you know, I mean, we can only speculate about, you know, how much, you know, what that interaction between Machaventa and the other 11 Melchizedeks, you know, what that entailed. I mean, how much were they wanting to kind of respect the natural evolutionary process of Machaventa doing things, you know, with his limited engagement? I mean, they apparently, that's really important. They respect that concept enough that he didn't just manifest physically. They actually incarnated him so that he has this limited awareness. So, you know, you could, along that line, you would probably speculate, they're not giving him lots of intel. You know, and kind of just letting it play out naturally, letting the evolutionary process really govern, you know, and not being micromanagers. You know, but
it's almost like he's even limiting his own intel. He could easily have people that would tell him. That's move 4,000 people.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Yeah, so see, again, there's also, you know, was he really busy? You know, but you know, you can just start speculating exactly how that came to be. But
he's going to have to get through stuff, you know, but messenger had to stop off. This battle probably didn't last very long either.
Maybe I should actually go back, you know, as long as I mentioned it, we're kind of dwelling on it a little bit longer. You know, I told you that vignette in Genesis is happening with that paragraph we just read. Remember, I read this last time, you know, it says, you know, and it is written, quote, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, was the priest of the Most High. Now, Melchizedek revealed the relations of this Most High observer to Abraham when he said, quote, and blessed be the Most High who has delivered your enemies into your hand. All right, this is the, you know, those four armies. So, you know, even though it isn't as magical as just 318 taking care of those four armies, you know, there's over 4,000 men in addition. Remember we talked about that. You're left to just speculate. Well, exactly what did the Most High Observer do to kind of guarantee this outcome? You know, it's the general question. You know, what does the Most High Observer do today to guarantee certain outcomes that he wants? Right? If it's something that's actually significant, not, you know, not because we think it's significant, which probably means it isn't, but if it really is significant, something that's going on in the kingdoms of men, right, and he wants it to end up a certain way, it's going to end up that way no matter what humans do or don't do. Right? If someone needs to win an election or lose an election or whatever, coincidentally, that person will win or lose that election.
Or a battle.
Or a battle, or, you know, whatever it is. Whatever in the kingdoms of men that you want to talk about. You're left to just speculate as much today is back then. Exactly how does he tweak this stuff? Not to mention when, you know. When is something really important? Right.
Of course they weren't allowed to do anything when they
killed
on the cross.
So yeah, I mean they don't explain. You know? You're left to just kind of speculate on that one. But one way or another, apparently it wasn't a given that just by the numbers or the training or something that Abraham and his army was going to win. The Most High did something. right?
He was convinced that he had hell.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was going to mention that. Yeah. You know, Abraham insisted that the God of Salem had given him victory. Yeah. See, and he apparently was even suspicious that something was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, why are all these guys' shoelaces tied together or something, you know? You know, yeah, whatever it was, you know? You know, and of course, remember, we mentioned that, you know, that you know, Machaventa using the Most High name for God has some validity just because of the Most High Observer, like we're seeing right here, you know, and Abraham saying it's the God of Salem, and Melchizedek is thinking, well, yeah, kind of sort of the way you think about it. It was the Most High Observer, right? Definitely got involved here. Now you can wonder, how did Machaventa know that? Kind of in what you were saying. He's kind of way late for the party here, but somehow he knows that the Most High Observer has intervened in some way and done something. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, did the Melchizedek receivers tell him something at that point? Or what? I don't know. There's so many questions that they don't give you enough to, you know, definitively answer here. Anyway, keep going here.
After this battle of Siddim, Abraham became leader of a second confederation of 11 tribes, and not only paid tithes to Melchizedek, but saw to it that all others in that vicinity did the same. His diplomatic dealings with the king of Sodom, together with the fear in which he was so generally held, resulted in the king of Sodom and others joining the Hebron Military Confederation. Abraham was really well on the way to establishing a powerful state in Palestine.
Okay, so it went from 7 to 11. Yeah, see, there was four armies. And then, you know, in the Bible, you've got these five armies against those four armies, and, you know, and those five involve Sodom and Gomorrah, kings and whatnot. So, you see, what actually happened is those other tribes and their kings, like Sodom and Gomorrah, for instance, they eventually kind of roll around and kind of join in on this ever more enlarging confederation as well. So there was, you know, a sorting out of the tribes. It just wasn't like the Bible story tells it, where you kind of have all the, you know, the heathens, you know, warring, and Abraham comes in and kind of just conquers that and kills everyone. You know, actually, it's you've got all these warring tribes, and Abraham is slowly coordinating them all into a cohesive group. See, it's not unlike what Muhammad, you know, did with all the ragtag Arabs. Finally, you know, where he had all these warring tribes and, you know, a million different tribal gods, like they were just talking about here a minute ago, and, you know, and he used the sword heavily to try to get them together into a cohesive group. You know, Abraham was definitely doing the same sort of approach and getting them to come together. Only Abraham had the you know, the non-physical influence of Melchizedek. You know, like they were saying there, everyone is so reverent about Melchizedek, and the fact that Abraham is close to him, and they all just fear Abraham. He doesn't have to go to war with most of them. He just goes, boo, and they say, yes, sir, right? It's a little bit easier for him to do this than it was for Muhammad to try to bring everyone together. So that gets you through the, you know, basically you're paralleling the Bible story. That gets you through that part. And now, you know, we move into where Melchizedek is, you know, I mean, basically from our perspective, we say that the Most High Observer is done with Abraham. Now, Machaventa Melchizedek, it's his turn to really, you know, get him into play to his ends. So that's the shift in the story here now.
Do you think maybe Melchizedek also at the time of Muhammad?
No. The Melchizedek's left at Jesus' time.
Okay.
They're not here anymore. Okay.
Section 6. Melchizedek's covenant with Abraham. Abraham envisaged the conquest of all Canaan. His determination was only weakened by the fact that Melchizedek would not sanction the undertaking. But Abraham had about decided to embark on the enterprise when the thought that he had no son to succeed him as ruler of this proposed kingdom began to worry him. He arranged another conference with Melchizedek, and it was in the course of this interview that the priest of Salem, the visible son of God, persuaded Abraham to abandon his scheme of material conquest and temporal rule in favor of the spiritual concept of the kingdom of heaven.
Okay, so, yeah, they're sorting out the story in the Bible. So the whole bit with, ending up with Isaac and all that, it didn't play like it is in the Bible. Sarah that's way past childbearing age and all that sort of stuff. But there was the issue of handing off, his efforts to someone. That was in play. And it was an important element. That's why it became an important element in the Bible story. It was an important element that Melchizedek was kind of leveraging off of to swing Abraham over in to his scheme, if you will, right? To his plan. So that's an interesting little element that having a son does play a key role in the actual historical story. Let's see, anything else there? Let's see. Oh, just maybe the fact of, remember when they said, how did they say that? Was fired with a zeal to go forth. Okay, tunnel vision, zeal, so much so it didn't even occur to him. It's like, wait a minute, who am I going to hand this over to? Okay, just how intensely focused he was. I mean, you think about historically a lot of the great leaders and kings and whatnot. I mean, the moment that they even begin to plan on some grand achievement, creating some great kingdom under them or something, they're figuring out how to get a son that they can hand it off to. I mean, that's like step one. In most historical stories, but it just shows you how intense Abraham was on his ideas, that he wasn't even thinking in those terms initially.
Yep. But I don't think initially he knew how successful he was going to be.
Right, you could maybe there is that maybe, but he definitely was planning. I mean, and like I said, I mean that's the thing. The kings in lots of stories, it's like some king in England a long time ago or something. He has all these plans. He doesn't know if he's going to be successful for certain. He believes he's going to be successful because it's divine right or something. But I mean, the very first thing he's planning, or his parents are planning for him or something. Is okay. You need to have a bride, and you need to get some offspring, because if you don't, I mean, you have a target on your back. No one is going, it's going to be et tu, brute, almost immediately, if you don't set up someone to, to hand this off to.
It sort of seems like he achieved more than he imagined.
Yes, yeah, he definitely did, yeah.
And so that brought him to his
senses. Yeah. Yes, as far as I remember, Bible, as he was achieving everything, it was all, first of all, it was with the help of God, and God was promising him a lot of descendants.
Yes, yes. That's coming here. We're about to read that. Yeah, yeah.
Like it was God who was doing all these.
Right.
In the Bible.
Yeah, in the Bible. Right. Yeah. See, we're going to see exactly how that rolled out here as we read this. That's coming right up here. Okay. So yeah, keep going.
Melchizedek explained to Abraham the futility of contending with the Amorite confederation, but made it equally clear that these backward clans were certainly committing suicide by their foolish practices, so that in a few generations they would be so weakened that the descendants of Abraham, meanwhile greatly increased, could easily overcome them.
So encouraging him to use his foresight and his insight, it's like, you don't have to kill them now. Let them continue to descend. And of course, you know, you're talking about a lot of the people that eventually Muhammad is going to try to whip into shape, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years later. Because in a lot of what the Amorites were is people in between the two legs of the Fertile Crescent, right, in between Palestine and Mesopotamia. You know, and they were constantly plaguing Mesopotamia over the millennia even. And occasionally taking control of Mesopotamia and then getting shoved out again. And so you can see, you know, they're besetting the Palestinian side of the Fertile Crescent as well. And Abraham is thinking he needs to just whip them all into shape. But
they don't say so specifically, but you can kind of guess that one of the foolish practices that they had was probably sacrificing the firstborn.
Yes, sacrificing the firstborn was definitely one of the foolish practices. Yes, exactly. Not to mention all the other human sacrifices that, you know, they might throw in, you know, to try to appease a vast pile of gods, right, that, you know, like they're pointing out. It's one thing to have human sacrifice to try to appease one god, but when you've got, you know, 300... Right, lots of people die, you know, and of course they always pick the best person to sacrifice. So, right, I mean, over time the genetics just is hopeless, with these people.
Look at Russia. Yeah. They put them in prison and kill them. The best mommy. Look what they did in Iraq.
Yep, there's still lots of that sort of thing that happens. Yep. Like I said, here it comes up, Farouk.
And Melchizedek made a formal covenant with Abraham at Salem. Said he to Abraham, quote, "Look now up to the heavens and number the stars if you are able. So numerous shall your seed be." End quote. And Abraham believed Melchizedek, quote, "And it was counted to him for righteousness." And then Melchizedek told Abraham the story of the future occupation of Canaan by his offspring after their sojourn in Egypt.
Okay, we'll get to the last part in a minute. But so, you know, they can quote from Genesis, you know, twice there. Okay, that was said. It's just it was said to Abraham by Melchizedek, not by the Lord. Okay. But as we can see, for many people back then, Melchizedek kind of was the Lord, right? I mean, you know, you have to wonder if that was kind of what those who were, you know, rewriting the story, you know, they could see in the story how Melchizedek was treated basically like God come down to earth, just complete reverence and whatnot. So, you know, they're thinking, well, okay, it wasn't in fact the Lord, but in truth it was. They're saying it was obviously the Lord, so let's just write it that way and keep it simple. See, they might have been actually thinking that way. Melchizedek is kind of on a mission where it's like, he who has seen me, you know, has seen the word of God, or he who's heard me has, you know, heard the word of God.
He's on a mission from God.
He is on a mission from God, kind of.
So he considered.
Yeah. See, so it may be that that's what those, you know, those scribes were, you know, they were kind of just going with that, what we would call the spirit of it, of the story, like that.
But he had a human body. He would say, I am God.
Right, right. It wasn't some mystical voice coming from the heavens, you know, booming from the heavens, like, you know, you'd think it was in the Bible story. It's just Melchizedek and Abraham talking face to face. And, you know, you not only have, you know, so numerous shall your seed be, okay, that sort of prediction, quote unquote, of the future. But look at the specificity again. Are we not calculable? Okay, and remember, in the Bible story, you think, oh, well, God knows everything, you know, so God tells Abraham this stuff. But no, this is Melchizedek telling him. Melchizedek says, and then Melchizedek told Abraham the story of the future occupation of Canaan by his offspring after they sojourn in Egypt. Right, so the whole, you know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, you know, Joseph, all that stuff. See, all that was calculable. They knew way in advance that Joseph, you know, all that, and they would, and eventually Moses would lead them out. They calculated all that way in advance. Okay, right, just. You know, it should really get you to appreciate that what I say all the time, I'm not exaggerating. Look at what it says there, that they're calculating in advance. Think about how many variables there are in play. You know, good grief. You know, I mean, we just saw how a drought led to, I mean, but they're calculating all that. They know exactly what the weather is going to be every day, you know, hundreds of years in advance. They know, you know, they know exactly how many people there are, how many dirt clods there are. They know this guy's going to trip over this dirt clod and that's going to cause this. I mean, they calculate everything.
Well, I mean, for starters, his wife couldn't bear a child, and he had only one child.
Yeah, of course, in the Bible story. But of course, actually.
Bible story, so yeah, he had only one wife. And they were already very, very old.
Oh, right, you know? Right, yeah. But of course, she's actually young and, you know, infertile and whatnot in reality. But, yeah, go ahead. You had a question?
It kind of justifies the common notion about prophets.
Yeah, about prophets, yeah.
Just being future tellers.
Yeah, yeah. See, in the degree to which celestials that can calculate all this stuff very precisely genuinely engage someone, so you're talking about a genuine prophet, not a delusional person, but a genuine prophet getting some information, yeah, it can be spot on predicting the future. You know, in the same way I can calculate where Mars is going to be in the night sky 300 years from now, you know. You know, it's, you're not seeing the future, you're just calculating it. Okay?
Rebellion and things like that weren't necessarily calculated.
Yeah, right. I mean,
you have to change your calculations.
Right. I mean, the Melchizedek set up a whole college. It's like, okay, we got to, you know, we got to redo all of our calculations on everything, you know, because of the rebellion. And Jesus was another, you know, Michael is doing that through another monkey wrench in it. They had to set up a whole college just to deal with that. And yeah,
yeah. But always calculate the whole astrology. Where the planets are going to be.
Right, I mean,
pretty simple.
Yeah, right. I mean, but, you know, but just to think about how, you know, we know that matter, you know, obeys laws. We have to just recognize mind energy obeys just as precise a laws. Spirit energy, spirit substance obeys just as precise a laws, and the interplay between the three energies is very precise. Right. It can all be calculated.
Personality and
voice. You know, I mean, you know, like we talked about back in the evolution of biology. I mean, you know, the life carriers designed a single-celled plant in just such a way so that 550 million years later, through all the vicissitudes of all that evolution, they would get a certain type of pre-sanguic will creature. Okay, and again, it's just, you know, we're talking just a few hundred years in advance. Okay, hundreds of millions of years, right? I mean, this is all very calculable, you know. Or like when we talk about the life carrier installations on high, you can go to those installations around Salvington. you can walk into some room or whatever, and you can dial up, okay, on a certain planet, you know, out of the millions in Salvington, I want to look at a particular single-celled animal on a particular planet. I want to see exactly what the quantity and quality of usage of the first adjutant is in that amoeba on that planet. And you can look it up to 90 decimal places, you know, in both cases. I mean, this is the kind of data that the universe has.
There must be something different about an experimental, because they did say a few things happened that they didn't expect to happen.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
in an experimental, there's some calculations.
But see, that's the interesting thing. See, it just shows you something about how they can, you know, even though it's a decimal world and they've loosened the constraints and they know there's going to be a bunch of things that, you know, that'll pop up that they aren't really considering, right? There's a red thread that they calculate through all that nonetheless. Even with all that loosened constraints, they can still, you know, did they get a pre-sanguine glow creature? Yes. Right? I mean,
they get bacteria viruses.
Yeah, right. They got, you know, there's a bunch of other things, yes. But you know, that just to appreciate this, you know, and what kind of things you'll observe on high, you know, like if you go to one of these models of, you know, a world or something, I mean, the kind of detail of this simulation that you'll be able to engage. I mean, you know, it isn't like us running a model of the atmosphere, you know, and we break it up into coarse chunks, you know, and we kind of sort of can calculate 2 minutes in advance, and then the model goes astray from what actually happens on the planet. I mean, you know, they can produce a model, you know, of anything in the universe that is just completely spot on to endless decimal places.
In the end,
yeah,
it's all the pattern of perfecting,
yeah,
so to speak, which is even way beyond.
Mm-hmm. You know, and to think, it's like, well, that just seems ridiculous. It's like, well, you know, there's even a being. I mean, the master physical controllers on this planet, you know, they don't relate to the planet as a certain number of molecules that they can grab a hold of. They relate to it as a certain number of ultimatons. And they grab each ultimaton individually. I mean, you know, that's just a being. You know, like I said, I mean, you know, you've got all these master physical controllers. You have 10 mechanical controllers on the planet. These incredibly powerful beings. I mean, that literally, you know, they have a hold of every ultimaton of the planet. All they do is have to think it, and they could rearrange those ultimatons into different atoms and make the entire planet into a giant daisy. Just like that. Okay? I mean, that, you know, just to appreciate, you know, there's so much projection that we have about what the universe is and how it works, you know. It's like, well, I can't even imagine, you know, having a consciousness of the number of molecules on the planet, so therefore no one does. It's like, no. I mean, the creative mother spirit is aware of every thought in every human, in every animal, in the entire local universe. She's conscious of every single one of our, you know, every cricket, you know, every will creature. She's conscious of all mindful thought. One being. Think of how many creatures there are in the local universe. And it's ridiculous to even think about how many will creatures there are, let alone creatures in general. How many insects are there? And yet you watch one insect, and it's so precise and stuff. You know, it's almost like there's this incredible consciousness focused in that tiny little, you know, protoplasm, you know, and a little exoskeleton. And there is. It's her consciousness is there. You know, if we would really think about how the universe really is, it would become a much less cold, scary place. It's incredibly enwombed all right, and known. And there's nothing to be afraid of. No real harm could befall you.
Right. And sort of answers how the healing at sundown went.
Yeah. Right.
How what?
The healing at sundown, he's thinking about, you know, the, you know, during the with Jesus, you know, how all those people were healed, you know, you know, and just in a moment, you know, I mean, you know, and that actually, you know, is a, you know, involved a lot more logistics, you know, so, you know, it didn't take a nanosecond, it took a little bit more than a nanosecond, you know, but still, it's just, I mean, all Jesus would have had to have done during his public ministry, you know, when he's fully power, personality, senses, all he'd done is just think it, you know, and the entire planet would have been in a perfect, settled state.
He had to be careful not to think
that. He had to be careful not to think that, right?
Well, why didn't he think that?
Because that would be in rebellion.
Oh.
It's an evolutionary world. Everything has to evolve. No one has the right to impose their will on things like that.
Set up his own law.
Okay. Meanwhile, back to the story. Right.
Well, back to the other question. He knows, has calculated the future 300 years ahead, and doesn't know that Abraham has taken
like I said, it's a mystery. You knew there. Yeah, you're left to speculate. We'll see some others coming up here. There's some things that they annoyingly don't tell you, right? Yeah.
Strategic blindness. So I'll just answer this question. There's a difference between knowing what's going on and being able to catch up with him in time. By the time he actually caught up with him.
Yeah, but if you know the future 300 years
ahead,
you can get a good enough
answer. He was teaching his classes.
Take this outside, guys. Okay.
This covenant of Melchizedek with Abraham represents the great Urantian agreement between divinity and humanity, whereby God agrees to do everything. Man only agrees to believe God's promises and follow his instructions. Heretofore, it had been believed that salvation could be secured only by works, sacrifices, and offerings. Now, Melchizedek again brought to Urantia the good news that salvation, favor with God, is to be had by faith. But this gospel of simple faith in God was too advanced. The Semitic tribesmen subsequently preferred to go back to the older sacrifices and atonement for sin by the shedding of blood.
And 2,000 years later, it was too advanced again. And everyone went back to the older sacrifices and atonement for sin by the shedding of blood. Right? Yeah. So the story just repeated itself. Melchizedek tried it, didn't go anywhere. Jesus tried it. You know, they just turned him into the sacrifice, the blood sacrifice and the atonement. Yeah, and it's just, to just let that sink in again, right? You know, that, but this gospel of simple faith in God was too advanced. Think about how, it's kind of, you know, backwards, it seems, when you first think about it. It's like, wait a minute, it's, you know, simple faith. How's that too advanced? But remember when we read the whole story about evolution of religion, you know, it was just every 5 minutes we added another wheel within the wheel, you know. It was just, I mean, that's what humans love to make it, just endlessly complicated. Okay, and I'm using humans in quotes. See, that's the difference between a human and us as fancy animals that are calculable. Right? The fancy animal makes things ever more complicated. The human makes things ever more simple. The human has the insight and the foresight and wisdom to cut through all of that foolishness and boil it down to the core essence. You know, and to build around that core essence, or just let it be, let it stand on its own without any filigree. You know, that you know, it takes a reflective human to recognize that in that simplicity is infinity. See, to assess it quality-wise instead of quantity-wise, where it gets more and more and more complicated, you know, until the tax code is so many pages no one can even count the number of pages, right? See, that's the fancy animal that does that, you know, and the religion, you know, where the Pharisees have so many regulations no one can even remember them all, right? I mean, so it's just like the tax code. See, that's what fancy animals do, because they know only quantity, and they want it to be profound, so the only thing you can do is...
complexify.
Yeah, complexify. Add. Right? Go above that to your human mind, right? That can cut through such foolishness and say, no, it's just this. All I need is a real nucleus. It's simple. A real faith grasp produces a real nucleus. And once I have a real nucleus, infinity just falls into place. Because that's how real that nucleus is. Right? It's not real unless infinity falls into place. It's just a temporal actuality. It isn't an eternal reality. And if it's an eternal reality, infinity comes along for the ride. Okay? You know, and it doesn't require, you know, endless pages of tax code.
Chris, even today, Hindu religion, especially in the old text, there's so much sacrifices and offerings that still, you know, and then in their text. And so I wish, you know, Michael would have saved them too.
Yeah,
reduced the amount of sacrifices.
Yeah.
And it's not blood sacrifice that I know of, but there
but
are.
But it's still. Yeah.
Maybe there is, but there are all kinds.
Not to mention the complexity.
Yes, the complexity.
You know, Hinduism, you know, is just like infinitely complex, you know, until you basically have a version of it for each individual in India. You know, it's just insanely complicated. Again, it's just that natural animal process. It's unnatural for things to be simple. Because being a human is unnatural, right? You have to choose to be a human, right? You have to choose to be unnatural and to simplify, to cut through the crap. Right? You got something else?
Well, I want you to comment on the italicized.
Oh.
That's important to me. Interesting,
and
how deep is that statement?
Yeah, I mean, remember we kind
God
of...
God agrees to do everything, man only agrees to
do everything. Yep. That the simplicity of that... And of course, the italicized faith, you know, reminding you when we went through the epical revelations, right? His basic approach, Machaventus, is trust and faith, right? That core fact of faith, and then the trust that's built on that. See that whereby God agrees to do everything, man only agrees to believe God's promises. That trust, see, is the way you can sum up that. You know,
everything italicized means not necessarily everything.
Right. But just, you know, the essence of a trust, a real trust that's predicated on a real faith. You know, it's like, no, I trust. I don't have to be worried about everything. No, God will take care of that. I mean, even in the outer life, the Most High Observer will take care of all that, the kingdoms of men. I don't have to really fret about that. Let me see if I can just focus on myself. And seeking first the kingdom of heaven within, and finding a cosmic character. And then if I actually have an enduring cosmic character, maybe coincidentally the powers that be will find some use for me in the external world. Right? You know, and maybe something will actually get better through me. But not if I don't make myself quality first.
I mean, you were mentioning a minute ago about about they couldn't, the sacrificing still going on and on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, one of the main messages of the Urantia book is to, you know, preach the teachings of Jesus versus the teachings about Jesus. The very simple teaching,
yeah.
which is basically getting them off the same human sacrifice again
yeah.
into, you know, the fact right. that...
The final paper in the book is the faith of Jesus. When all is said and done, that's what it's about. He nucleated himself as a true man. He really nucleated himself. You do likewise. You need to have the exact same faith that he had, because that's real faith. Right? And Machavanta was preaching the exact same gospel.
And as he says, it's a simple faith, and as you're saying,
yeah.
and I think you know, it, you can sort of see that mankind, humankind, whatever you want to call it, is definitely wanting that, looking for something like that.
Yeah.
But it's, they just don't know it.
The natural part is just so, I mean, it's like, well, I don't know, I've got to have some rituals, don't I? Yeah, remember, you know, we talked about that not too long ago. I mean, Jesus understood that. It's like, well, okay, you know, I know that they're not just going to go with simple faith. Let me give them, you know, a remembrance supper ritual. Let me, you know, I'll try to boil it down some instead of 5,000 rituals, okay, you know, or whatever, 5,000 commandments. But still, when all is said and done, right, you know, you don't become part of reality because of the remembrance supper or because of baptism. Or whatever, right? You become a part of reality because in your real inner life, you really take a hold of the nucleus of a relationship to reality. You know, and you do that transcendent of your feelings, and you do that in spite of all of your instincts.
Right, and at our stage, or my stage, I'll speak for myself, you do that through faith.
Yeah.
You can't, you know,
right. It's just
not advanced enough to do it through
faith. It's not works. You know? There's no works righteousness. You don't need to do anything. Now, obviously, if you really initiate, okay, then one must do something as well as be something. Okay, now we're talking about the fifth epoch of Revelation. But the fourth, okay, you don't have to do anything. You need to be. You need to really be. You need to take hold of reality. Yeah, and not just, you know, exalt your animal origin nature and call it profound.
Chris?
Yep.
We have a pope right now, which is, you know, millions of Catholics, millions, and they're required to go and drink the blood of Jesus and the wafer, which is his
mm-hmm.
body,
right.
every day.
Sure.
I mean, that's the...
Yeah, like we've talked, like we've talked about. That's right. That's just the blood sacrifice, you know, and atonement still in play. Yep.
No, oh, well, I just wanted
you got something too. Okay.
Back to the just a quick.
We may get to the next paragraph.
Well,
yeah.
Back to the simplicity thing. There's a quote I like from Leonardo da Vinci. I think that
mm-hmm.
simplicity is the greatest sophistication.
Mm-hmm. Kind of. Yeah. Right, yeah. Which is a very clever way to, you know, pithy way to say what I was just saying. Yes. Right.
It was not long after the establishment of this covenant that Isaac, the son of Abraham, was born in accordance with the promise of Melchizedek. After the birth of Isaac, Abraham took a very solemn attitude toward his covenant with Melchizedek, going over to Salem to have it stated in writing. It was at this public and formal acceptance of the covenant that he changed his name from Abram to Abraham.
Okay, so see, some of those things happened. Okay, but see, it wasn't the covenant is you know, is set up with Melchizedek, you know, instead of with the Lord, and you don't have a promise from one of the celestial visitors about Isaac. That's Melchizedek telling him that. So, you know, again, they're sorting out the Bible story for you to tell you how it actually played out historically. And you did have the thing going from Abram to Abraham. You know, I guess we could assume, you know, it also went from Sarai to Sarah. like the Bible says too. But Abram to Abraham, you know, is going from, you know, father is exalted to father of many. Right? So he changes his name to match the prediction, you know, that he's going to be father of many. Yeah. You know, and you know, having a solemn thing and whatnot, and as we'll see in a second, you know, the mores that we've read about in evolutionary religion are about to come into play in the next paragraph here.
Most of the Salem believers had practiced circumcision, though it had never been made obligatory by Melchizedek. Now Abraham had always so opposed circumcision that on this occasion he decided to solemnize the event by formally accepting this rite in token of the ratification of the Salem covenant.
So that's actually how circumcision got into it, as opposed to the Lord, you know, says, you know, blank, blank, blank. So it, you know, they're just pointing out, you know, instead of having the all between being the Lord and Abraham, you've got Melchizedek involved in some of it. Some of it is just Abraham, you know, kind of going with what people think makes something very consecrated and serious and et cetera, as opposed to it all kind of coming down from on high.
Male circumcision.
Yeah. Of course.
It was following this real and public surrender of his personal ambitions in behalf of the larger plans of Melchizedek that the three celestial beings appeared to him on the plains of Mamre. This was an appearance of fact, notwithstanding its association with the subsequently fabricated narratives relating to the natural destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And these legends of the happenings of those days indicate how retarded were the morals and ethics of even so recent a time.
Okay, a couple things there. You know, so one thing, you know, about the circumcision. You know, remember how they said above that the faith was okay. That's just like, no, it can't be just faith. You know, we need to go back to the older sacrifices and atonement for sin by the shedding of blood. Yeah, remember, circumcision, you know, it's not going to be, he's not going to be demonstrating how serious he is about this unless there's a sacrifice, right? And that's what the circumcision is. So, you know, even right there, see, he's bringing in sacrifice instead of just simple faith. But then they go on here in what we just read. So here's, you know, all kinds of unanswered questions. So they're validating that there were three celestial beings that appeared to him. We don't know what kind of beings they are still. We don't know why exactly. You know, it just says it was following this real and public surrender of his personal ambitions in behalf of the larger plans of Melchizedek that. Okay, but okay, exactly why, what was the point? You know, in the Bible story, you know, they come, you know, and they say, no, Sarah, you know, you're not too old, you're gonna have, you know, a son, and then the whole bit about destroying Sodom and Gomorrah, like they're talking about, and that whole back and forth. Okay, so none of that actually happened with the three celestial beings. You know, we already read that it was Melchizedek that was telling Abraham about, you know, him having a son and everything. So, what's the deal with these three celestial beings? Now, if I had to guess, at least one of them was probably a brilliant evening star. It's because they kind of give you hints that those are the beings that, you know, kind of would do this sort of a thing. Maybe all three of them were, I don't know. But you know, it's interesting that they validate that part of the story, but what is the deal with it? I have no idea, really. If you look in the Bible story, there's nothing else there really besides, Abraham and Sarah fussing and giving him all kinds of fancy stuff to eat, and then them telling her that she's going to have a son, and then the whole Sodom and Gomorrah rigmarole. So,
it was Lot, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the whole bit with Lot and all that, routine, because he's like we read, he was actually living in Sodom, and yeah. But there was no God destroying Sodom and Gomorrah because of the wickedness or anything like that. It was some natural cataclysm.
Okay. What about Ishmael? Is there any mention of Ishmael?
That doesn't immediately enter the story here. But there actually was an Ishmael and all that. I mean, that's the basic elements in those stories in the Bible are valid. It's just the quote unquote moral of the story. You need to always wonder if that's been modified. But the basic historical element: there was an Abraham, there was a Lot, there was a Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember, a lot of people today wonder if there ever was a Sodom and Gomorrah, if that's all just made up. Between the lines here, we've just validated no, there was a Sodom and Gomorrah. And they even just validated that. Yeah, and it was a gnarly place. like they said, and these legends of the happenings of those days indicate how retarded were the morals and ethics of even so recent a time. So it was apparently a rough place. But the details of the story, may not have any historical, factual nature. I don't know. Okay.
Upon the consummation of the solemn covenant, the reconciliation between Abraham and Melchizedek was complete. Abraham again assumed the civil and military leadership of the Salem colony, which at its height carried over 100,000 regular tithe payers on the rolls of the Melchizedek Brotherhood. Abraham greatly improved the Salem temple and provided new tents for the entire school. He not only extended the tithing system, but also instituted many improved methods of conducting the business of the school, besides contributing greatly to the better handling of the Department of Missionary Propaganda. He also did much to effect improvement of the herds and the reorganization of the Salem dairying projects. Abraham was a shrewd and efficient businessman, a wealthy man for his day. He was not overly pious, but he was thoroughly sincere, and he did believe in Machaventa Melchizedek.
Okay. He has all of this practical ability, not unlike Moses, right? And why, it's not just mythology that he was a very influential individual and did indeed get the ball rolling on what came to be the Jewish people. Okay, you can see very organized, very gung ho, and they got tons of money. Like they're pointing out, you got everyone tithing as far as the eye can see in every direction. You imagine how you wonder how fancy that first Salem temple was. For those days, they definitely had a lot of money to build lots of tents, and I'm sure there were lots of tents. But remember they're Bedouins, so the whole tent thing, just like with the Arabs today, even still. And here again we see the Melchizedek missionaries, getting coordinated and organized and started officially, and so not surprising what the next section is. We're going to start next time. We'll read about the Melchizedek missionaries. And isn't it interesting that that Abraham played such a significant role, not just Machaventa, in getting that well coordinated and set up and going? It's not unlike Adam and Eve didn't really organize and launch, you know, the ambassadors there. That was Seth, right? It's the Sethite priesthood. So you had kind of a similar thing here, that Abraham played a significant role, you know, in the logistics department, if you will. And so he was, you know, what did they say? That intelligence, initiative, sagacity, and sincerity. And the sincerity thing you saw at the very end. He was not overly pious, right? But he was thoroughly sincere. And he did believe in Machiavelli and Melchizedek. So it ends up being a, you know, it's a so much more real story when you take out all the magical folderol and stuff. You know, and you can really, really enjoy and kind of, you know, delight in what you can envision this interaction between Abraham and Melchizedek actually being like. You know, it'd be great to have a movie, you know, of those days to play out that story and, you know, the way it really rolled out.
I'm struck by the last statement. It didn't say that he lived in the teachings.
No.
He believed in them.
Yeah, and you know, for those in the webinar, if you can hear, he was struck by it. It doesn't say he believed the teachings of Machiavelli and Melchizedek. It just says, and he did believe in Machiavelli and Melchizedek. And when all is said and done, is that not appropriate? Since the revelation is not the teachings of Melchizedek of Salem, the revelation is Melchizedek of Salem. Right? He believed in the genuine faith character of Machiavelli, Melchizedek. That reality was enough for him. That recognized reality was enough for him. And that's what, you know, if you're going to identify with Jesus of Nazareth, it's the same way, right? You know, and that's, again, like I said, that's why the last paper is the faith of Jesus. That's the point of identification. Not with all of his fancy doings, you know, not the free food and the free health care. Right, it's the faith of Jesus. That's what you should identify with. And that's a worthy identification. You know, especially since, like they said, you don't have chosen people, but you do have chosen individuals. Melchizedek was a chosen individual. Jesus was a chosen individual. Abraham was a chosen individual. You know, your identification there is not a mistake. Okay, so like I said, we'll pick up the story about the Melchizedek missionaries next time. And, you know, that's getting us going towards the greater story and the rest of the papers in this block here. You got one more little question first?
And he did believe in Machiavelli, Melchizedek.
Mm-hmm.
So, this Melchizedek had a human body.
Yes, yes, yes.
So it wasn't really faith, unless he, I wonder if he did any miracles.
No, no.
Materializing.
No, he didn't. No.
So then he just believed in somebody who looked like a human.
Yeah. Well, and it's just, you know, like I was trying to stress, that belief, you know, like they try to point out, this belief is not superficial. He's not believing in Machiavelli and Melchizedek for what Melchizedek does. He's believing in Machiavelli for what he is.
Godlike
dignity. He had a godlike dignity, yes. I mean, even letting the little word in sink in, right? He believed in, right? The faith nucleus in Machiavelli, right? Right? To take that more literally, just to emphasize that, right? To believe in that faith nucleus integrity. to identify with that, to honor that, to follow that.
It refers back to the covenant between Melchizedek and Abraham,
mm-hmm.
between divinity and humanity, not deity and humanity.
Yeah.
It's the divinity of Melchizedek.
Yeah, the God-likeness or the deity-likeness of Melchizedek, right, is, right, to identify with that. Honor the God-likeness you see in your fellow man. Respect that. You know,
I dare say we'd all believe in him too if he were here.
Yeah.
Because of the way he just, you know,
right.
Look what he is.
Right.
To begin with.
Right. Anyway. Yeah, in the same way that Jesus had the similar impact on people in his day. Right. For those who really followed him, it wasn't all of the folderol, right? It wasn't his outer life. It was his inner life that they honored. Okay. So, like I said, next time we'll pick up the whole outer life thing with the missionaries. But wait till next time here. Let's take a moment, everyone.